This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. How are children with mood or behavior disorders evaluated and diagnosed? How are they treated? When are psychiatric drugs prescribed? What are the risks of these drugs for children? And how long should a child be on medication? Millions of American children are taking psychiatric drugs. On the program today, we're going to ask the question, to medicate or not? Our guest is board-certified child and adolescent psychiatrist, Dr. Glenn Elliott. He is the director of the Children's Center at Langley Porter at the University of California at San Francisco Hospital. The center provides patient care. It trains child and adolescent psychiatrists, general psychiatry residents, and medical students. It also conducts research. Dr. Elliott is also the author with Kate Kelly of Medicating Young Minds, How to Know If Psychiatric Drugs Will Help or Hurt Your Child. Listeners, I invite your telephone calls for our guest, Dr. Glenn Elliott. You can join us with questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. He has a doctorate degree in neuro and biobehavioral sciences. He is the author of dozens of studies on the use of psychiatric drugs in children and adolescents. His guide for parents, Medicating Young Minds, How to Know If Psychiatric Drugs Will Help or Hurt Your Child, is published by Stuart Tabori and Chang. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Elliott, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's a pleasure being with you.
Tell us a little bit about the range of problems you see in your practice out there in San Francisco.
Well, one of the both fascinating and difficult parts of child psychiatry is that we see individuals anywhere from quite young, 2 or 3 years of age, up to 16, 17. So it's difficult to generalize because you end up wanting to talk about a particular age group. Mm-hmm. With younger children, preschoolers, usually autism is a very significant concern, as is mental retardation, and some sorts of really persistent behavioral problems that are still poorly understood. Kids who simply are extremely fragile, where just any little thing may set them off and make them sort of melt down.
Yeah, okay. We've already got a caller, a listener, wanting to talk with you, and they're on a cell phone, so let's go and take this call before you and I talk further.
You bet.
Listener on line one, cell phone, good afternoon.
Hi, I have two questions for you. One is for you to comment on. The first is, I personally, since I was young, have had OCD and anxiety, and I didn't find out until I was over 50 that I had Asperger's syndrome when my sister, who was a psychiatric nurse, said, yeah, you have all the symptoms. And she said, but you don't have, those aren't psychiatric illnesses, that's your personality. And the other things you have are what they call comorbidities. And I'm very concerned that in dealing with youth, and I've talked to a lot of doctors, they have no idea what Asperger's is, and they have no idea how to deal with it. And that they're trying to, you know, make, for example, socialize boys who are fundamentally different than women in, because there's a gender difference in that. So I'd like you to talk a little bit about that. The second thing which concerns me is the zealots, and I'm talking about Peter Breggin.
Mm-hmm.
And people who write, your psychiatric medicines may be your problem. And I don't know how to counter that. I'm very concerned about the fact that people aren't being trained adequately to be aware of some of the illnesses, and they're also taking these extreme positions, yes or no, and not knowing how to mix them. And what do you comment on those things?
Sure. Well, I think certainly one of the huge changes that's happened in my professional lifetime, which dates back to the 1980s, is that we are becoming more aware of certain kinds of disorders than we were before. I think that's largely a good thing, although sometimes, as you've sort of suggested, it can lead to sort of either complete overdiagnosis of things or sort of worries about how could we have missed it all these years. I would say Asperger's is certainly a disorder both that may be becoming more common, that's quite controversial, but certainly is being diagnosed much more frequently and recognized, I think, when it is present. Another one that I find fascinating because it emerged during my professional life is attention deficit disorder, which we used to think was a disorder just of childhood and now recognize that it's can affect people throughout their life. The broader question of extremism is actually part of what my book, Medicating Young Minds, is about. I think often parents find themselves being pointed to books that either say, yes, your child has X, Y, or Z, or, all of these things are complete fictions. And the reality, in my opinion, lies somewhere in between. Medications can be extremely useful and can be extremely potent. They can also do real harm. And being aware that both of the things are true is absolutely essential.
Hmm. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Dr. Glenn Elliott, author of Medicating Young Minds, How to Know If Psychiatric Drugs Will Help or Hurt Your Child. This is The Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. You mentioned in the book Medicating Young Minds that when parents come to you, they may tell you their child is fill in the blank, ADHD. Mm-hmm. They may have reached that conclusion on their own or at the suggestion of a teacher or a pediatrician. Who should evaluate a child to see if there is a problem and offer a diagnosis?
Well, again, this partly depends on the diagnosis and on the age of the child. Certainly someone with real expertise in childhood mental disorders, and that's not typically your average pediatrician. I think the important part is that evaluations take time. Anybody who offers you a 5-minute diagnosis, you should be skeptical. We don't have nice blood tests for this. We don't have the checklists are interesting and potentially useful as screeners, but they don't make diagnoses.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, that at the end of the book, you write a piece about a boy named Josh.
Uh-huh.
And we won't go into that story right now, but I was really happy to see that you said, Josh is a child, not a diagnosis.
Yeah, I very much feel that way. I mean, partly, in some ways, it's a frustration with my field. I wish we could make diagnoses, but the reality is I think that's true not just in psychiatry, but really across medicine. But particularly with children, and that's part of what I was trying to emphasize in that story, is, and the previous caller, I think, touched on as
mm-hmm.
well, part of the difficulty here is we're talking about a life as well as a diagnosis. And if somebody has Asperger's disorder, that doesn't mean that that's who they are. It means that they're likely to do some things well and some things relatively unwell. Trying to understand how to make sure that the rest of life goes as well as it can is really one of the focuses that I think we need to make, not do I have a disorder and how do I fix it?
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Champaign, line one. Hi.
Yes, good afternoon. Having watched my great nephew with his struggle with various childhood problems like Tourette's and OCD and Asperger's syndrome, I realized that all the boys in our family seemed to have these traits. And which was, we didn't know, when my son was born, which was 40 years ago, high operating autism, just wasn't
sure.
Even on the radar at that time.
Absolutely not.
And so we knew that he was, awkward and had all these perceptual problems. So he's now 40, and, you know, I know that the topic is childhood mental illness, and I'm happy to say that my grandson, who began to exhibit OCD and who was put for about a year and a half on a tiny dose of Prozac, is now off and seems to be doing quite well. But what does an adult who kind of, you know, missed, and the parents missed the diagnosis, you know, years ago, where would a 40-year-old go looking now for some life skills?
Yeah, unfortunately, it's highly regional dependent. In some ways, ADHD presents much of the same problem. There are a whole variety of skills that you've either failed to pick up or are going to have trouble picking up because of your because of your illness that don't get any easier as we get older. Depending on the region, it you know, there may be a few resources. They're often, you have to go to big cities like Chicago, San Francisco, New York. It's a real dilemma because the expertise lies in people who work with children, and many of them, including myself, tend not to work with adults because there aren't enough of us to work with the kids that we need to work with. Many adult professionals, psychologists and psychiatrists, simply don't know what to do.
Right.
They don't have the training. So,
and we all have OCD, and finding a psychologist who can deal with OCD is almost impossible.
Yes, exactly. Many of the national organizations can be helpful. These days, parent organizations are patient organizations for almost everything. There's a wonderful organization for trichotillomania, which has to do with compulsive hair pulling.
Right.
But there is a national OCD organization. There's also NAMI, National Alliance for the Mentally Ill.
And there is the OCD Foundation, which is excellent,
right.
Which I
right.
have belonged to for years and have learned a lot about, and they have a wonderful newsletter that they put out. So if anybody's listening who has that kind of approach, has that kind of problem, they're really excellent.
Yeah, thank you. One thing that particularly with adults, is often a really good start is actually reading about what's going on. There are some excellent books out there. Again, going to some of these national organizations can really help to they're discriminating in terms of what books they list, so they can often be very helpful in sort of thinking about what to do. But I think, you know, the biggest problem, and I don't know what's going on with your son, but a lot of times adults simply don't see themselves as having a problem, or if they have a problem, they don't see themselves as being able or wanting to fix it. And a huge issue in psychiatry, particularly with adolescents as well as older individuals, is if I don't want help, how can you make me get it? And the answer is, you know, we can't force anyone to get help. So one of the hard parts for families is that you may have to sort of identify the issue, say that there is help out there, try to give some resources, but then, especially with late adolescents and adults, you pretty much have to let them make the decision to seek help.
Well, we did suggest to my son, and he has been working with an intern because the psychiatrist who works with OCD is overwhelmed.
Yep.
And that has proven very, very helpful.
Good.
But there are no adult people who work with. You know, I used to say to my pediatrician, he's so slow about doing this and that. Oh, no, he's in the normal range. So, well, maybe when we train more people to work with youngsters, maybe these same people will have time to work with adults as well.
I hope so, although the amount of work keeps rising. So,
well, let's talk with another listener. Caller on a cell phone, line two, hi.
Hi, doctor. As a veteran educator, it appears, and it's, you know, obviously the literature supports this, that for instance, different childhood behavior disorders have, you know, erupted in the last, or at least been diagnosed in the last 5 to 10 years, especially autism. First, what do you attribute that to? And secondly, it appears also, maybe I'm incorrect on this, that pharmacology, psychopharmacology, and the treatment of some of these disorders has eclipsed other forms of intervention. And then thirdly, for those individuals in the audience who may not be familiar with some of the terms that have been thrown around, like OCD, Asperger's, and Tourette's, and autism, if you can just briefly, in a layman's term, describe those, and I'll listen in.
Okay, thanks for those questions.
Well, yeah, those are very helpful. Well, where to begin? Let's start with the last, just because it's a little easy. OCD stands for obsessive compulsive disorder, which has to do with individuals, and it can be very young. I've seen it in kids as young as 4 who become overwhelmed with recurrent thoughts and compulsive actions, things that they feel they have to do, usually to ease those thoughts or because of those thoughts, that really sort of take over their lives. It's not just a, you know, step on a crack and you're going to break your mother's back kind of idea. It is a real need to touch a doorknob over and over again, or to eat foods in a particular order, or almost anything, wash your hands because they might be dirty. And we all have a little bit of that, but when it becomes really pervasive in your life and taking over hours and hours each day, that becomes a problem. Autism and what's called Asperger's disorder, which we think are related, has to do with a biologic problem that relates to decreased ability to interact with other individuals. And often it's associated with mental retardation, at least the autism is. Asperger's tend to be more normal or even above normal intelligence individuals who have just enormous problems with reading cues of and dealing with other individuals. Often there are language problems as well, and typically pretty odd behaviors, some of which look like obsessive compulsive disorder. So that's another area. And then Tourette disorder, which I don't think we talked about, I guess the previous caller mm-hmm. mentioned, is a movement disorder, what are called tics, motor tics, which are muscle twitches, which can often involve the face, but can involve any part of the body. And again, when they're mild, and you actually see lots of 8 and 9 year old boys particularly who have tics, they're pretty mild, but they can get very severe, and they can also involve what are called vocal tics, which are utterances that the child has little to no control over. So these are all disorders that we describe in my book, of course. In terms of the increased incidence, particularly of autism, it's a highly debated part of the field. We have some good news in that some of the things that people thought might be related, for example, mercury toxicity, immunizations, those have now been pretty thoroughly disproven as likely causes. There still is vast disagreement in the field about whether there's no disagreement that there are lots more diagnoses being made. The uncertainty is whether it's because it's become more prevalent or whether we're just recognizing things that we previously either diagnosed as something else or didn't diagnose at all. And I think it may be a little of both. Certainly we're making diagnoses in kids that we often wouldn't have diagnosed in a few years back. But we haven't completely ruled out that there may be something going on that's helping to change the way people are growing up.
Yeah, and the last thing that the caller raised was therapies, and there are other therapies besides medication out there, and you list them in your book: play therapy, floor time, cognitive therapy, behavior therapy, and on and on.
Yeah, it's a very appropriate question, and I mean, I'll sort of start by apologizing for my particular specialty, which is use of medications. It's really what I went into medicine to do. When I started in the mid-80s, it was actually done very rarely, and we knew almost nothing about it. We've learned a great deal over the last 20 years, and it certainly is being used much, much more commonly than it was before, and there are times when it can be extremely effective. I think part of the pressure to use medications, certainly people often blame the drug companies, and I wouldn't disagree that the drug companies would like us to use medications, but that is by no means the only reason. As I mentioned in the book, the average pediatrician these days has roughly 15 minutes to see two patients, of which 5 minutes is supposed to be devoted to doing record keeping. So roughly every 15 minutes, he has to spend 5 minutes doing the books and see patients for roughly 5 minutes each. It's really tough to do much other than grab a prescription pad and write a prescription. And there has been a lot of pressure in a lot of different areas to look for a quick fix. And when medications work, they really can be a quick fix. The problems are, as I talk about a lot in my book, there are lots of things for which medications just don't work at all. For example, medications don't really treat autism. We know that. There's less, all of those other interventions take more time and often are less well understood and less well studied. So I think there is reason to be worried that somehow medications have become preeminent and you know, are being used too much, and I think at times that's absolutely true. It isn't the only treatments that people have been studying. For example, obsessive-compulsive disorder, which we just talked about, there are very good studies that show that medications can be helpful, but the behavioral, certain kinds of behavioral therapies called cognitive behavioral therapies also can be helpful, often with the medications or independently of it.
Yeah. I want to go back to the previous caller, the caller from Champaign, the lady in Champaign.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we talked a little bit about their, you know, normal range, and that's really hard to define, isn't it? I guess my question is, you know, when should a parent seek help?
Well, it's a great question, and there's one end that is easy to say and is important nonetheless, and that is when things start going really badly, it's time to sort of try to figure out why. One of the astonishing things about obsessive-compulsive disorder, for example, and I think it's a little less common now than it was when I started 20 years ago, is the degree to which whole families can get embroiled in an obsessive set of behaviors that take up hours. I had a patient, one of my very first patients, who actually also happened to have autism, but his obsessions literally took him 8 hours a day. He could only have one meal a day because 3 hours were required to get through a meal. And the family didn't even think about seeking help until the school said, we can't take this anymore because of things that he was doing at school. A literal component of every diagnosis that psychiatry makes, what we call our Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, or DSM, requires what we call impairment. That is, not just that you have symptoms, but it really has to be causing you or somebody else around you lots of problems. So the first thing is, if you or your child are engaged in things on a recurrent basis that are really causing problems for the family and that aren't going away, it's time to ask somebody for help. You may not need to jump into a full diagnosis, but at least even if you just start with talking to a neighbor you trust or a member of the church, if you're involved in church, somebody who says, you know, here's what's going on. I can't tell because I'm too close to it. Is this a problem? Do you see anything? That's one. The other is if you see an abrupt change, one that I like to point out because frankly, I missed it in my family with one of our two children, is if you've got a child who's doing really well in school and suddenly things aren't going well in school, mm-hmm. that's always a bad sign. Doesn't tell you what's going on, but children who like school and do well in it don't just suddenly stop doing well.
Yeah, there's an anecdote in the book about a young man who was very tidy in his room,
mm-hmm.
and was a bright and happy fellow, and then suddenly things changed. And thank goodness his folks got him some help because he was severely depressed.
Right, and I'm sure my son wouldn't mind doing our older son. There were several years where, it took us too long to see the pattern, but in late December, early January, his grades would go from A's and B's down to D's and F's. And, you know, we wouldn't hear about it, of course, till the grade card showed up. And by that point, whatever was going on would go away. And he's a very secretive young man, so it took a while to actually find out what was happening. But but ultimately, we found out he was having some short depressive episodes that the problem with depression, and it's true in adults and it's no less true in kids, is it doesn't make you likely to go out and say, hey, I'm feeling really bad. it almost by definition tends to make you more quiet, more less likely to seek help.
Yeah. Well, eventually this family, there was a physician that this young man had, you know, he trusted. And so they took him because mom and dad were apparently asking, you know, what's wrong?
And that's right. And often, particularly with adolescents, mom and dad are the last people that the adolescent is
going to
talk
to. Yeah,
yeah, it's completely development appropriate. We had one of each. We had one that would tell us absolutely anything that he did, whether we wanted to hear it or not, and another one who would tell us, but usually 5 to 6 years after it was all over. And the typical adolescent, as they hit into that 13, 14 years of age, and certainly a little beyond that, is going to be distrustful of the parents. They feel like the parents are really causing a lot of the problems. And if they're having difficulties, often they feel like the parents, if they're not causing it, they're certainly not fixing it. So parents may find themselves really frustrated. Turning to a trusted doctor, again, to a trusted friend, not to help necessarily, but to sort of see, you know, we've noticed a problem, we're really worried, can you tell us what's going on?
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, board-certified child and adolescent psychiatrist Dr. Glenn Elliott. He's the director of the Children's Center at Langley Porter at the University of California at San Francisco Hospital. He's also the author with Kate Kelly of Medicating Young Minds, How to Know If Psychiatric Drugs Will Help or Hurt Your Child. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite your questions this afternoon, your comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, when it comes to that moment when you realize you really need some professional help, which professional, what kind of professional do you turn to, and what should a parent know about the qualifications of that particular professional? What are the useful questions to ask?
Well, certainly you need to start by getting somebody who's actually trained to work with children and somebody who's trained to work with mental health. One of the dilemmas, and I wish I had a nice, clean answer, is, you know, do you go with a specialist? You know, I'm convinced my child has autism, so I'm going to go see a child, you know, an expert in autism. Or do you seek out somebody who's got a broader set of skills, so that if you're wrong, if your child has a learning disorder or speech delay or something else, you're not wasting your money on a, you know, intensive evaluation that really isn't needed or appropriate for your child. So what? Unfortunately, we don't have a nice website where you can turn and be sure that you're going to get the right kind of an evaluation. I think to begin with, if you trust your pediatrician, talking to him or her about what your concerns are and what people he's used in the past for evaluations can be very useful. For older kids, teachers often have good resources where they've people that they've used in the past and trusted. I sound like I'm bad-mouthing pediatricians, and I really don't mean to do that. One thing that I sometimes recommend, for example, a child with ADHD, is to call in advance and say, look, I'm really worried about this. I need some additional time to ask for an extended evaluation so that you've got more time to sort of draw on the pediatrician's expertise. And that sometimes can be a very good start. For many of these disorders, you really do need an expert. I list a whole bunch of different folk. Child and adolescent psychiatrists are the only ones who are physicians trained initially in adult psychiatry, and then we get additional training 2 years in child psychiatry. So we have both the medical background and the specific training in child mental disorders. Child psychologists psychology has a somewhat odd system in that there are no real child psychologists. Those are people who have decided to do their sort of advanced training in with children, but they don't get a degree in child psychology. You can find out where they did their training, what kind of kids they worked with, and what ages. You really want to hone in on the age of the child, because most of us are not broad experts. I work with autistic kids and do certainly know young kids with autism, but I wouldn't want to be assessing 2 and 3 year olds with other kinds of severe mental disorders, because that's not my area of expertise. So finding out what ages the professional works with is really really essential as well.
Okay. And you know, back to, let's talk again a little bit more about Josh.
Mm-hmm.
Taking a look at his at the complete picture of this little guy. I think he's 4 years old.
Yeah.
You know, you want to take a look at all the things that are going on in his life. And I mm-hmm. suppose parents, if they stop and they could do some of this themselves, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's probably the other thing that kind of baffles me. There are two things that I spend a lot of time at the beginning of the book talking about, you know, how to prepare yourself for this. One is, if you've never done it before, be prepared to be asked questions that you're not used to. you know, professionals are going to ask about how your marriage is going, what else is happening in your life, not because they're morbidly curious, but because there are certain kinds of disorders that really come out of a child's sort of awareness of and reaction to what the parents think he doesn't know about. So parents who are in the process of getting a divorce, maybe even before they've announced it to anybody, often have an enormous amount of tension in the home that kids react to. And they can end up with quite severe anxiety problems. They can end up having what looks like attention deficit disorder because they're not paying attention, because they're spending all their time wondering if mom or dad are, you know, about mm-hmm. to leave. So that kind of information is going to get asked about. Parents sometimes feel like they're being blamed, and that's not the intent. The intent is to make sure that we get as broad a set of possibilities ruled out as we can. Another thing that really is important is, if you've got records or evaluations, one thing, there may be a child who does something, like has a really huge temper tantrum and the rest of the time looks perfectly normal. One thing I often suggest to families is, if you can catch something like that on videotape, it can be worth gold, because you can actually see what's happening at the time. And there are, for example, seizures that might cause that. And if you look at it, you can pretty rapidly decide that's not a seizure or it is. If you don't see it, you just hear about it. Mm-hmm. It can be really hard to know what's going on.
Yeah. But one of the things that was going on with Josh is, he was a little guy who had a lot of medical interventions when he was an infant, a baby.
Uh-huh.
And so then that, you know, that plays into how that little guy sees the world.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
and all of those things are, and again, that's part of why it's really important to get somebody who knows about that particular age, because although, you know, we all get training in child psychiatry and in child psychology both about what, you know, what different kids look like, it's one thing to get training, and it's another thing to have seen 20, 30, 40, 100 kids with similar kinds of issues.
Mm. Dr. Glenn Elliott, our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's a board-certified child and adolescent psychiatrist and the author of Medicating Young Minds. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Okay, so let's say a physician now has recommended, I think, a prescription drug mm-hmm. or drugs is in order. How does the parent then, or parents, evaluate that recommendation?
Well, the first thing to go back to is this issue of impairment. You know, what's happening and how bad is it? All treatments, and I really go way past medication here, involve an evaluation of two imponderables. One is, how much benefit can we get, and the other is, how much bad things are going to happen as a result of it. But to begin with, you sort of need to know where you are. So, you know, how much is this interfering, not just with the family, but with the child's real ability to function? Is this causing him to be ostracized by his peers? Is this interfering with his ability to learn what he needs to learn in school? Really, how bad is this, and what's sort of feasible. One thing that I try to be as honest with as I can is, you know, what do we really hope to achieve with the medication? What kinds of things are reasonable? I mentioned earlier that autism doesn't respond to medication, which is certainly true, but there are a number of behaviors that autistic kids are more likely to have, for example, obsessive-compulsive-like behaviors that medication sometimes can make enormous differences in. So I'm not going to be treating the autism, but what I would do as a care provider would be to say, okay, here are the things that one can reasonably expect the medication might help. Here's how we'll know if it's going to be better or not. And unfortunately, here are the side effects that you might reasonably want to worry about. And this ultimately is a decision that I can't make. I can provide the best information. I can certainly say what I would do if it were my child. But ultimately, the parents have to decide, do we or don't we want to see whether or not things are going to get better with medications.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Bloomington, Illinois, line 4. Hi.
Hi there. Hi, doctor. We have a 7-year-old son with autism, was diagnosed at about age 3, and originally was diagnosed with bipolar, and even the consideration of schizophrenia has been considered, and it still is being considered. He has all the typical autistic tendencies, OCD, but we've tried a myriad of medications. We've been on Zyprexa, Ativan, other mood stabilizing medications, and we've done the seizure route and everything. The only thing we've had some marginal success with is a biomedical intervention along with dietary, but he still has every few months these psychotic type episodic things that he'll go through, usually lasting 1 to 3 weeks. And it's at that time that we'll administer rectal Valium or Zyprexa, but and that kind of helps him skate through it. But do you have any recommendations on or even any information on what might be causing that?
Hard to make a diagnosis on the phone by any means, but what kind of, when you say psychotic-like behavior, what's he actually doing?
Well, he'll do a lot of the obsessive-compulsive things that he does, but a lot of talking to himself and then screaming out. He has been hospitalized for violent types of behavior. He's only 7, but when he gets in one of these episodes, he can be very, very strong, and he'll break things and attack people. He's hurt several of the family members. I've had to take some extreme measures just to try to get things under control until we can get some medical intervention. But we want to keep him in the home. We don't want to have him, living in a hospital-type environment or outside of the home, because when he's doing well, things go great, and he's a wonderful child. But we never, quite get through these episodes without being, burned. And I worry that it's just going to get worse as he gets older.
Sure. One thing that happens is the kids get older, they also get bigger. So things that you can tolerate at 3 or 5 become really impossible.
I'm sorry, doctor. Just a second. I've got to switch the phone.
I think her battery in that particular phone is going out on her. Why don't I just reintroduce you, doctor, and then we'll get her back on her phone and you can continue to talk with her. Mm-hmm. Glenn Elliott is our guest this afternoon. He's the author of Medicating Young Minds, How to Know if Psychiatric Drugs Will Help or Hurt Your Child. He is the director of the Children's Center at Langley Porter at the University of California at San Francisco Hospital. He is a board-certified child and adolescent psychiatrist. Now let's see if we've got that listener back in Bloomington. Hi. Are you there? No. Maybe she'll call back.
Okay.
In the meantime, though, perhaps she's listening. You want to follow
well,
up?
Well, as I said, it's close to impossible to try to figure out exactly what's going on. These kinds of disruptive, what we call episodic disruptive behaviors, which are common, certainly common with autism, but actually happen in other ways, are, the bane of our existence, because it's a little like having an electrical short. It's sometimes, that's intermittent. It can be almost impossible to track it down. You have to sort of be there when it's happening. And from a medication point of view, there aren't good things to stop relatively brief kinds of problems like that. We often end up with chronic medication in the hopes of reducing it. For some individuals, it really is a matter of really recurrent anxiety, trying to understand sort of what is going on that leads up to it. Maybe useful, but it sounds like they've tried to do that. Aggressive behavior, that kind of losing it, is a common kind of issue, and we do end up using sometimes some pretty potent medications to see if we can try to help the parents deal with that, because she's absolutely right. These are the kinds of things that get kids so that they can't stay at home, so that they can't go to school.
Yeah. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Southern Illinois on line one. Hi.
Hello. I'm a speech therapist, and I have worked with children with autism, and I'm wondering if you could comment, number one, on the effect of diagnosing food allergies with children with autism, and number two, if you're familiar with Carol Gray and her social stories and shaping behavior through social stories.
I'm not a big believer in food allergies as a large explanation for autism or any of the other disorders that it sometimes is attributed to. It's not something that I view myself as an expert in. I actually do talk about this in my book. If my patients want to try it out, I try to give them some guidelines, just as I would with medication, about what to look for and to be aware of, particularly placebo effects. But the evidence really hasn't been very convincing over the years that it accounts for much of the causes of either autism or ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, which are two common disorders for which allergies are often attributed. In terms of the social stories, I am familiar with that as a way. One of the problems, particularly with more higher functioning kids with autism or Asperger's disorder, many of them have a lot of difficulties with understanding and dealing with their same age peers, the people that would normally be friends. And there are a variety of techniques that have been used that are beginning to try to help them find strategies for doing that. What a lot of these individuals sort of have to do is, and I believe that's part of what she does, what a lot of these individuals have to do is to learn by rote things that the rest of us sort of take for granted because it just comes without us having to think about it. And that can be helpful. It still doesn't fix the underlying problem, but it can give them very useful tools.
Well, thank you. I look forward to reading your book.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. These medications can be pretty potent things. That's why we turn to them, because we want to alleviate the suffering, the pain. We want to, you know, when you say we've got this huge impairment, we want to lessen that so the person can function better. But, you know, can these medicines have long-term effects on the development of young brains? And we know now that brains are developing in children into their early 20s, right?
Absolutely. The more we know, the longer the timeline seems to be. I think most of us thought that we kind of hit the nail of calling adolescents 18 or 19. Now the brain studies are really showing that, at least if we think of adolescence as the end of development, it's probably more in the early, I think 22, 23 is now kind of the common target. It's a great question. It's one that we are still probably several years away from even having the tools to study in any detail. It is one, though, I want to put in a slightly different light, because there are some beautiful studies that were done several years ago now that showed that with obsessive-compulsive disorder, that when people have control of their symptoms, there are changes that can be identified in the way the brain is functioning that are quite clear and quite reproducible. That happens, it turns out, whether you use medications or cognitive behavioral therapy, both of which have been shown to be helpful in treating obsessive-compulsive disorder. Now, whether or not those are direct changes in the brain or changes that reflect the fact that you're no longer obsessing all the time is not not so easy to tease out. But clearly there are changes in, demonstrable changes in how active certain parts of the brain are when you're less ill. And you can do that both with medications and with behavior. The reason I'm pointing that out is that, yes, we should worry about do medications produce long-term changes in the brain that might be bad. And unfortunately, I mean, the good news is nobody's shown that to be the case. The bad news is we really have very little in the way of tools to even ask the question the appropriate way. But what I want to emphasize is the other thing that we have to worry about is the disorders that we're talking about really can profoundly impair mm-hmm. a child's ability to function, and that also, that inability to function, might produce long-term changes both in the brain and certainly in the way, mm-hmm. you know, the life you can look forward to. Kids with ADHD, attention deficit disorder, for example, often, I mean, as a group, they pick an age and you can find bad things that happen to them. And, you know, an effective treatment that really helps them avoid the bad things that happen if they're not treated has to be balanced against any theoretical concerns about what medicines might do in the long term.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Elliott, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Glenn Elliott has been our guest this afternoon. He's board-certified child and adolescent psychiatrist, director of the Children's Center at Langley Porter at the University of California at San Francisco Hospital, and the author of Medicating Young Minds, How to Know if Psychiatric Drugs Will Help or Hurt Your Child.